to Resettled Radio, brought to you by the ARCC, live on Planet FM.
Stay tuned for current affairs, conversation, interviews, music and more,
as we explore the perspectives and stories from resettled communities,
and bring you information from within the resettlement sector.
You are listening to Resettled Radio, brought to you live by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. I will be your host. I'm your host for the day. I'm Galwak Shul. And you are listening to Basaku Kayote, a song by Bala from Mali. I will bring you such music from all over the continent. More of the same music will be coming to you shortly. Please enjoy. Thank you. Welcome back. If you have just tuned in, you have been listening to Resolar Radio, brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6, and I will be your host for the day. I'm Garlo Akshol, and I will be playing to you some of the music as we get along through the program. But before that, I would like to play you two resettlement stories today from our history book. And this is the thing, because in ARCC, we believe that people connect through these stories. And this connection is what I'm trying to put across today. You will be hearing some of the struggle and the success and the stories of the people who came here to seek a better life. And these are the people who have made New Zealand their home. And they are the Kiwis. They are the new Kiwis, as we call ourselves. We are not refugees anymore, even if we came to this country as refugees. So we have become part of this society, and we are part of building this great nation. And I will bring you two of them. I do not want to bore you with, you know, with who these are. Actually, I do not want to give you a clue of what they are trying to say, but I will be playing to you two stories, and in between I will be coming with some music, and I will entertain you all along. So be ready. I'm playing the first one.
I am from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Democratic Republic of Congo is a French-speaking nation, so I did all of my education in French. Not many Congolese people speak English. My family is a big African family. I have my mum and dad, four brothers and two sisters. I am the youngest. My family lived in a village called Goma, the eastern region of Democratic Republic of Congo, where I was born and raised and where I spent most of my life. My life in Goma had been good until foreign forces came and took control over my country. The foreign forces used their organized militias to lynch innocent people. After the president and military dictator of Democratic Republic of Congo, at the time my country was called Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko, was overthrown in 1996, the instability in Democratic Republic of Congo became worse because of mass murders. Even ordinary families were targeted, but no one was ever held accountable for the crimes committed. At that time, my older brother worked at a human rights agency in Kinshasa, the capital city of Democratic Republic of Congo. His job mostly involved recording and reporting atrocities committed by various armed groups. Because of my older brother's work as a human rights activist, unknown people sent us hate messages numerous times and threatened our lives. Later, they launched a massive hunt to kill my older brother, so he had to go into hiding, and I accompanied him. They were so determined to kill my older brother and the rest of our family. One day, our family heard that some armed men came to our village and killed three of our family's friends for failing to locate us. The armed men took the bodies into the bush, chopped them into parts, and displayed the cut-off parts in our village. The killers did so as a way of sending a message to us that no one in our family would be spared. The unfortunate killing of our family's friends was shocking. We felt frightened. The scariest part was that we didn't even know who these armed men were. They could be anyone. They could even have been state-sponsored organized groups. We had no idea. Knowing that our family was in imminent danger, my older brother talked to the Red Cross, requesting that our family should be smuggled out through the border to Uganda. The Red Cross knew about the threat to our family, so we were all crammed into a car marked as the Red Cross and secretly driven to the Uganda border. Fortunately, we managed to escape safely. From the Ugandan border, we started to look for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda. In a United Nations High Commissioner office, we were able to register ourselves as refugees under protection. The officer asked us to stay in a refugee camp in Uganda. However, my older brother resisted the idea of our family staying at a refugee camp. He demanded that we should live in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. This was because the refugee camp was so poorly protected and we could easily be killed. I also felt that those who wanted to exterminate us in Democratic Republic of Congo might still be pursuing us on Ugandan soil. In the end, our family was able to move to Kampala and stay there. Sadly, my older brother's wife died soon after in Kampala due to what the post-mortem report described as poisoning. I also got scared. I felt that from that moment on, any one of us could die at any time. Not long after the tragic death of my brother's wife, one of his twin sons also passed away by poisoning. It was a double tragedy for our family. Later, we found out that those killers had indeed pursued us all the way from Democratic Republic of Congo to Uganda. This made me think that the enemy might have already been at the refugee camp, mingling with us unknowingly, and that they could see us, but we could not see them. Our family felt so anxious that we had to request to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to arrange settlement to another country under a protection case. The United States, Canada, and Australia were on our top three choices. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was fully convinced that our lives were indeed in danger. In the beginning of 2002, we lodged our application for resettlement, and we waited until any country accepted our application. While waiting in the refugee camp in Kampala, my cousin and I opened a tailoring shop. The little income that we received from the tailoring business supplemented the meager assistance that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees had provided us. Canada was the first country that responded to our application. Unfortunately, it declined our request for resettlement, but they did not provide any reason. We later learned from our friends that Canada accepted only refugees with small-sized families and people who speak proper English for resettlement. Our family consisted of 15 members. That's a small village. Also, no one in our family spoke good English. We had lived in Kampala for 7 years as refugees. At that time, I was still single, but my older brother remarried. Despite the help from the rest of us, it was still hard for him to take care of all his young children. In the beginning of 2009, New Zealand responded to our case, and we heard that our application was finally successful. At the end of 2009, our family arrived in New Zealand. Life in New Zealand was different to Democratic Republic of Congo. First of all, I couldn't speak English at all, because I had never gone to any English school. All I knew in English was the word good. So when people asked me, "How are you?" I answered, "Good." When people asked me, "Where are you going?" I replied, "Good." When people asked me, "How long have you been here?" I said, "Good." Sometimes I even responded in French. In the first 6 weeks in New Zealand, we stayed at Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre. And then all 15 of us were taken from Auckland to Hamilton for resettlement. Once we arrived in Hamilton, volunteers from the Refugee and Migrant Services offered us a lot of support. For the first 6 months, they helped us with opening bank accounts, shopping, paying bills, and managing our lives in this new home, city, and country. The Congolese and Sudanese communities in Auckland also gave us a lot of support for our resettlement in Hamilton. The hardest thing as a newcomer in Hamilton was to find a job. It was very difficult to get one. Most employers asked me if I had any work experience in New Zealand. I couldn't understand why I needed work experience in New Zealand for a job that anyone was capable of. Having a prerequisite for work experiences in New Zealand would have been a great challenge for any immigrants from refugee backgrounds who had just arrived. Initially, I came to New Zealand with a mindset that I would not depend on social welfare. I was determined to start working straight away. But with the New Zealand employment system, I had to. I think many immigrants would have caught up with things quickly if they were given chances to be trained for jobs. Some immigrants would come to New Zealand with big dreams, but those dreams could not progress without securing a job. I was able to get a full-time cleaning job for night shift while I was studying a 2-year English course at the Waikato Institute of Technology in Hamilton. A good friend of mine at school introduced me to someone who knew a cleaning company, and I applied for a cleaning job. I learned that networking was very important to find a job in New Zealand. As an immigrant, it was even difficult to get a cleaning job. It's hard to get a job without knowing anyone. I started going to work at night while going to school during the day. After completing the English course, my English had improved a lot. I enrolled for a certificate in social practice.
Come back to the other part of the story, but giving you a break with Arabic song, a beautiful Arabic song, and we'll come back to the other part of the story. We will continue with that part, with the first part, and after the first part we will go to another music break, and we will come back with the second part of the story. Enjoy the Arabic song. Welcome back. If you are listening to the radio, you are listening to Razzle Radio, brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM 104.6. And your host for the day, Galwaxul. You have been just listening to one of the most beautiful songs in Arabic, and who says we need a translation when it comes to the music. So you go with the tune, right? This is what I usually do. Just go with the flow. But all in all, it's a great song, and it's talking about love and nothing more than love. So that's a very good song. So let's continue with that part of the story, and I will be playing you some music later on when we come back, when we have a little break. It's coming shortly. Bear with us.
For the first 6 months, they helped us with opening bank accounts, shopping, paying bills, and managing our lives in this new home, city, and country. The Congolese and Sudanese communities in Auckland also gave us a lot of support for our resettlement in Hamilton. The hardest thing as a newcomer in Hamilton was to find a job. It was very difficult to get one. Most employers asked me if I had any work experience in New Zealand. I couldn't understand why I needed work experience in New Zealand for a job that anyone was capable of. Having a prerequisite for work experiences in New Zealand would have been a great challenge for any immigrants from refugee backgrounds who had just arrived. Initially, I came to New Zealand with a mindset that I would not depend on social welfare. I was determined to start working straight away. But with the New Zealand employment system, I had to. I think many immigrants would have caught up with things quickly if they were given chances to be trained for jobs. Some immigrants would come to New Zealand with big dreams, but those dreams could not progress without securing a job. I was able to get a full-time cleaning job for night shift while I was studying a 2-year English course at the Waikato Institute of Technology in Hamilton. A good friend of mine at school introduced me to someone who knew a cleaning company, and I applied for a cleaning job. I learned that networking was very important to find a job in New Zealand. As an immigrant, it was even difficult to get a cleaning job. It's hard to get a job without knowing anyone. I started going to work at night while going to school during the day. After completing the English course, my English had improved a lot. I enrolled for a certificate in social practice, and I completed it in 2013. Some employers entertain racial profiling at the workplace, despite it being against the law. At my cleaning job, I was called many racial names. Although they all knew my last name, Butu, which was easy to pronounce for anyone, my colleagues would say things like, "Hey, Blackie, bring this and that." I was upset. The more disturbing thing was that even when I raised the issue of racial discrimination to my supervisor, he never acted. When I approached my manager, he didn't take any action either. In the end, I quit my job because racism affected me mentally at work. My Indian workmate in the same company went through the same racial discrimination, and he also quit his job. With this experience of racial discrimination, I didn't know who to turn to for help, especially after my manager didn't do anything to stop what was going on. I felt like I didn't belong. A word of advice to new immigrants and those who are coming to settle in New Zealand is that it is a completely different environment here. Be prepared for culture shock. You may not find a job as quickly as you wish upon your arrival, or your boss might be lenient with racial discrimination in the workplace. Weather and social life are also different. Life in New Zealand is good. People are friendly. Kids go to school for free, and healthcare is awesome. But it's so stressful if you don't have family members who will be on your side for moral support. In New Zealand, you can say anything or do anything you wish as long as you don't cross the line. Freedom of speech or freedom to associate with anyone is pretty much provided to anybody in New Zealand. But some people quickly abuse these freedoms. Many young immigrants quickly forget that it was a lack of such freedoms that forced them out of their respective countries in the first place. I came to New Zealand to rebuild my life. I am currently a second-year student studying for a Bachelor of Social Work in Auckland while working part-time. My dream is to work with people and help them. New Zealand is my home. and I have to contribute to building it.
That's the end of the first story, the struggle of a young man from Democratic Republic of Congo. And we will go to the second story after this break. Enjoy the music by Charlie Black.
And I fight over my then I fight back. Put your hand on me, you funny bite back. You like that, you bite back. Girl, you sexy sucking. Shape like an half chicken pill. Drink a apple fat up on me bill. You bump up your hand, girl. See the bite back, you come chill. A bike short time, show me your skill. From Albert Town to Caliville. You bump up your hand, girl. Time for me, wine for me, wine for me, girl. Time for me, time for me, time for me, girl. Wind up your body in and the bike show like you are entertained party criminal. Shape for me, shape for me, shape for me, girl. Vibrate, vibrate, vibrate for me, girl. When the country boy can't ever go on the road, make sure don't hate for me, girl. Cock up your big bumper on the bike back. Bumper ready for the RR bike back. See the junk on it, you can't ride that. You like that, the bike back. In your shot up shots, on the bike back. Tell a fight over, man, you're not fight back. Put your hand on me, we just on the bike back. You like that, the bike back. Girl, you're sexy, something. Shape like a half chicken pill. Drink a apple fat cup on me bill. You bump up for a hot girl. See the bike back, you come chill. A bike short time, show me your skill. From Catado, Pat the Flower Hill. You bump up for a hot girl. Put all your ears, some wine for the wheels. Me ready for defend your life, me ever seals. Team unstoppable, no make fair deals. As of today, me a pay your deal. You no pay for your bumper, baby, it's real. You damn good food, you no damn mean deal. No lank, you no bite, you a that me reveal. Some girl look tough, tough, tough like a steel. Wine for me, wine for me, wine for me, girl. Time for me, time for me, time for me, girl. Wind up your body in and the bike show like you a entertain party criminal. Shape for me, shape for me, shape for me, girl. Vibrate, vibrate, vibrate for me, girl. When the country boy can't ever go on the road, make sure don't late for me, girl.
That phone in the car so you can't make no sound. Econax sound is a Econax sound. That phone in the car so you can't make no sound. Econax sound is a Econax sound. That phone in the car so you can't make no sound. Econax sound is a Econax sound. That phone in the car so you can't make no sound.
That is music played by Charlie Blacks from Jamaica, and I will bring you another music from Uganda, played by Eddie Kenzo, Maria Rosa. Enjoy. If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Resonant Radio brought to you by ARCC on Planet FM. I'm your host for today, Galwak Shul. And please do not go away because we will bring you the second part of this story, the resettlement story in Auckland, after the next music. This is Amsal Mech from Ethiopia, praising his country.
Magagyal, you're in the blind. Yeah. To them I see it and me wonder and me ask myself why. Alright, and every model got a shape like a Coca-Cola bottle. Why? But this year in the back of my mind, but girl, me want to
That is Mr. Killer, Roly Poly. It's great music from, I think, from Trinidad. And I will be bringing you the second part of the story. And this is the story about a man, Ethiopian man who lived in Eritrea for some time and moved to Sudan, but he struggled a lot. And this is what he said. And welcome.
I think that we do have to be measured. I do think we have to be prepared to put in good resource to ensure that the resettlement is a positive experience, both for those people coming here and for the people living in New Zealand already.
I am from Ethiopia. I spent the years of my youth liberating my people in Ethiopia. I joined the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a mass rebellion movement established to overthrow the communist dictator, Colonel Mengistu Haile Mariam. Initially, Haile Mariam came into power in 1978 after overthrowing the emperor, Haile Selassie, in a bloody coup. After the coup, this communist dictator ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist. He used an autocratic military mechanism that he called Derg, and the rest of the world called Red Terror. He committed genocide throughout his tenure in office. He also relied on the Soviet Union for economic plans, which yielded no favorable results. Eventually, Ethiopia was hit by terrible famine. As a result of his dictatorship, Tigray People's Liberation Front and other armed forces of Ethiopia formed an alliance. In May 1991, we were able to overthrow the communist dictator. After removal of the Derg, or Red Terror, regime, all of the armed forces, including Tigray People's Liberation Front, merged and formed a transitional government under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front in an effort to restore democracy and the rule of law. I was honoured to serve in the transitional government under Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi Aris. I was a big man, holding an influential position in Ethiopia, but I was not happy with the government that I served. This was because there were a lot of abuses of the rights we had fought for as a nation. There was no space to speak up. Although the new Prime Minister had made a lot of economic recovery within a short period of time, he failed to deliver democracy. He used to talk about fighting for democracy and civil rights, but there was only lip service. Eventually, my unhappiness with the new regime was noticed by the intelligent apparatus, and my basic rights were breached. In 1993, I decided to flee Ethiopia. Bearing in mind that the Ethiopian government was looking for me, I asked one of my relatives to accompany me to Eritrea to avoid suspicion along the way. We both dressed up and acted like farmers and set out to the northern region of Ethiopia. We walked for 4 horrible days to reach the nearest town in Eritrea. When we arrived, I went straight to the Dikembe military base, the largest military base in Eritrea, because I didn't know anybody. I was hoping that I could get a temporary permit that would allow me to stay legally in Eritrea. Luckily, I was able to obtain the temporary permit that I needed. I had to spend days without food because I didn't have any money to buy food. I had a gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch that I could sell, but nobody could buy them. This was because the trade law in Eritrea required that I must have a receipt for anything that I wanted to sell. Unfortunately, I had no receipt. People might have thought that I'd stolen them, so nobody wanted to buy my items. In the end, I became a hungry man in the streets of Asmara, the capital city of Eritrea. I also didn't have a place to sleep. I searched for a place to spend a night, but I couldn't find one. So I went to the nearest police station to spend the night in jail. The police officer in the night duty asked me, "What do you want?" "I want to spend a night in jail," I told him. "Why? Have you killed anybody?" the police officer asked. "No, I haven't committed any crime, sir. I'm new in town and I don't know anybody. I'm flat broke. I just want to spend a night here. I'll leave tomorrow morning," I replied. He noticed that I was very weak, so he opened the door for me. "You'll sleep in a woman's cell. There are no female prisoners today," he replied, and directed me to the cell. I consented to the police officer and followed his directions. I slept on the bare, cold floor without a bed or blanket. It was an awful night. No one offered me a place to spend the night except the prison. "This is an interesting world," I said to myself as I fell asleep. In the morning, I woke up and thanked the police officer for his kindness, and then I disappeared into the streets. As soon as I stepped out of the prison, I met a shoeshiner. "I have gold necklace and a flashy citizen watch with me, and I want to sell them cheap. Would you be interested?" I asked. "Oh, good, I want your watch. How much are you selling for? It looks expensive," the shoeshiner replied. 120 Ethiopian birr, but I don't have the receipts." "Never mind about the receipts," the shoeshiner replied, and agreed to buy the flashy citizen watch. "I'll give you 20 birr as a tip," I replied, after receiving the 100 birr from him. My life in Asmara was not good. I didn't feel well, and I even had a suicide plan. Eventually, I decided to look for help. I used the 80 birr out of my 100 birr to make a phone call to one of my relatives in Saudi Arabia, asking for immediate financial help. My relative immediately reacted to my situation and sent me 1,000 birr within a few minutes. I was overexcited. I felt like a millionaire. Happiness was written all over my face. My mission was to get out of Africa. By any means, I wanted to get out of Eritrea because I felt insecure. If Ethiopian authorities had ever found me, I would have been arrested or killed. I had to act quickly. I approached several embassies in Asmara to get a visa out of Eritrea. However, all of the embassies I contacted declined to provide me with a visa. It was only the Italian embassy that was willing to issue me a visa, but they wanted to charge me US$3,000, and there's no way that I could possibly afford it. So my search for a visa failed terribly. I even went to the American consulate to seek help, but the rude American senior employee didn't want to talk to me. He also looked down on me. I asked him, "Can you help me find where to go to be helped as a refugee?" "Okay, this guy will take you to the place that deals with people like you. Just follow him," he replied, and instructed one of his guys on what to do. There I met Peter Cook, the general manager of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I presented my case to him, a political refugee case. He listened to me and said, "I will first check your details in Ethiopia to make sure that you indeed ran away for political reasons." He took my details, including my job title, work address, home phone number and address. He wanted to verify whether I could be granted as a political asylum under United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Eritrea. A few days later, I was called to Peter Cook's office to be briefed about the facts he had found about me in Ethiopia. He said, "I agree with you that you have indeed escaped Ethiopia for political reasons, so I consent to provide you the protection you need." As of the 1st of January 1994, I became the first refugee in Eritrea. I was granted political asylum under the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees with available and valid reasons. At that time, Eritrea was the newest nation, and a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees branch had just been established there. Peter Cook offered me a job, but I turned his offer down because I wasn't interested in working. I just wanted to get out of the vicinity of Ethiopia. It would take no time and energy for Ethiopian intelligence officers to find me in Eritrea. One time, two Ethiopian security operatives even tried to kidnap me in Eritrea's Port Massawa, and I was only able to survive with the help of my cousin. The people at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees knew my life was at risk, so I was told to go to Sudan in a manner that resembled deportation. I had no choice but to accept to go to Khartoum, Sudan, for my own safety. This was after I'd been living in Eritrea for a year and a half. This had been a difficult time, for I was also dealing with the loss of my son, who had died back in Ethiopia. Life in Khartoum was a bit better than Eritrea. I got a job with an Irish non-governmental organisation in Khartoum to support myself. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees told me that my case was preferred for Australia. Several months had passed without hearing from Australia. After a long waiting period, I finally heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It's so unfortunate that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Sudan was so corrupted. You have to bribe the key United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees employees to get your file processed, said the officer. In 1997, I was offered a chance to resettle in Canada with three other political asylum colleagues. I satisfied all of their requirements. I met all the costs, including the medical checkup. I paid 600,000 Sudanese dollars, roughly equivalent to US$1,000. I was medically fit and everything was good. This application looked promising in every single way, but for unknown reasons, the case died. By that time, I felt like all of my doors were closed. I had heard that political refugee cases were processed urgently and that political asylum seekers usually got cleared for resettlement within a month by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. However, I spent 6 months staying in Sudan, and while waiting, I lost hope. Then unexpectedly, good luck knocked at my door. An interview with a woman for a chance to resettle in New Zealand. I was blown away with this great news. I didn't expect anything at this point in time. I got ready for the interview. This Kiwi woman who interviewed me was super polite. She felt sorry for me after hearing my story. Political asylum seekers do not have to wait 6 months without being given a chance to resettle. This category is always urgent, said the Kiwi woman. I finished the interview and she told me, "You will be resettling in New Zealand." I was super excited. I spent most of that afternoon reading about New Zealand online because I'd never heard of this tiny, peaceful nation. The resettlement process was also expedited. I came to New Zealand in 2000. I stayed in the Mangere Refugee Resettlement Centre upon arrival. After 6 weeks, it was time to move into the communities. I wanted to live in Auckland, so I talked to Housing New Zealand. However, my request was declined because I was destined for Wellington. regardless of the decision on the resettlement location. I didn't really like how the employees of Housing New Zealand treated me in processing my case. They were so rude, but I brushed off their rudeness. Luckily, two Kiwi friends took me to their house to stay with them. This was my first taste of kindness in New Zealand. I liked the country already. I stayed with these two friends in their house in Auckland for 2 years. Life in Auckland was crazy. It was a new way of life with terrible weather. It was hard to cope. Culture shock is a big thing that affects all immigrants, and I was no exception. Although I was lucky to be able to speak English, I had to pay extra attention when listening because people here speak very fast. Searching for a job is the main headache for newly arrived immigrants. I was a certified nurse back home, but I was told that my existing knowledge and skills wouldn't matter here, especially if I'd never worked in the field in New Zealand in the last 5 years. My nursing diploma was of no use unless I upgraded it, so I enrolled for a course and found a job in a supermarket. Through my supermarket job, I earned some money. Finally, after years on the run, I was able to support my wife, whom I'd left in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. I started a process of bringing my family to New Zealand through the family sponsorship program. In 2002, my family joined me in Auckland. I was very happy. I talked to Housing New Zealand again and asked them about accommodation. Surprisingly, they acted differently this time. They provided my family with a house and we stayed together as a family once again after 9 painful years apart. I'm currently a self-employed city taxi driver. Taxi driving is good and terrible at the same time. It's good in a way that you're your own boss, but it's terrible in a sense that you can get robbed and the police wouldn't respond to your calls as urgently as possible. Sometimes a passenger wouldn't pay me because of my race, and even when I've reported an incident, no actions have been taken. There's not much protection for people of colour in the taxi business. One time, a drunken passenger vomited in my taxi but refused to clean it when I asked him to. I called the police, but when you don't talk like a Kiwi, they don't respond to your call quickly. There's a lot of racism in the taxi business, but that doesn't override my love for New Zealand. One good thing about New Zealand is that it provides a lot of democratic spaces. You can breathe out your frustration until your lungs are exhausted. In Africa, the police are viewed as an enemy of the communities, but in New Zealand, police are the best friends of the communities. The healthcare system here is superb. Most people are very polite, although you encounter some rude people like in Housing New Zealand. But people help you when you're in dire need. One time, my expectant wife went into labour and called an ambulance. While she was hurrying to the hospital, she gave birth on the motorway. She got all the help she needed along the way. There are no such services in Ethiopia, Eritrea, or Sudan. New Zealand is my home, and my kids have a future here, and they know it. I'll take this opportunity to thank Eritrea and Sudan for their hospitality, and thank the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for the care. And for those who want to immigrate to New Zealand, I'll say that this is a great country to live, but you have to come with a clear goal and program. As long as you respect the law, respect other people, and know what you're doing, you'll be good. Some people start messing up on arrival because they don't know what they're looking for in life once they get to New Zealand. They expect everything here to be a bed of roses. Francesca Marciano couldn't have put it better when he said, "When you leave Africa, as the plane lifts, you feel that more than leaving a continent, you're leaving a state of mind. Whatever awaits you at the other end of your journey will be of a different order of existence. So be prepared."
We have come to the end of our program with this story. This is one of the stories we have, and we will bring you more maybe next week and have the rest of the week. And then see you next Saturday. I'm Galwakshul. Bye-bye.
That was our show for this week.
Take care until next Saturday, same time, 10 to 5, on Planet FM 104.6.
And on the web, www.plantaudio.org.nz/resetter.